speaker before him droned on for 2 hours. What he said is long forgotten. When it comes to the actual day, the last thing you want is to be worried about time. To avoid this, use your rehearsals to fine-tune your talk. You should plan to cut your material until you're sure you can finish well under the limit. This will allow time for audience laughter and a wee glitch or two. On the day itself, if you know you're going to be okay on time, it will allow you to focus 100% on the topic you should be focused on, explaining with passion the idea you care so much about. Spoken word artist Reeves has a nice guideline here. Your finish line is your time times 0.9. Write and rehearse a talk that is 9/10 the time you were given. 1 hour equals 54 minutes. 10 minutes equals 9. 18 minutes equals 16 minutes 12 seconds. Yes, it is. Then get on stage and ignore the clock. You'll have breathing room to pace yourself, to pause, to screw up a little, to milk the audience response. Plus, your writing will be tighter and you'll stand out from the other speakers who are dancing to the rhythms of the same time limit. Let's sum it up. For a high-stakes talk, it's very important to rehearse multiple times, preferably in front of people you trust. Work on it until it's comfortably under your allocated time limit and insist on honest feedback from your rehearsal audience. Your goal is to end up with a talk whose structure is second nature to you so that you can concentrate on meaning what you say. 13. Open and close. What kind of impression would you like to make? Whether or not you memorize your talk, it's important to pay attention to how you begin and how you end it. At the beginning of your talk, you have about a minute to intrigue people with what you'll be saying. And the way you end will strongly influence how your talk is remembered. However you deliver the rest of your talk, I strongly encourage you to script and memorize the opening minute and the closing lines. It helps with nerves, with confidence, and with impact. Audience attention is a truly precious commodity. You always have it when you first arrive on stage. Don't fritter it away with small talk. It really, truly doesn't matter that much that you are honored to be there or that the organizer's wife needs to be thanked. What matters is persuading the audience that they dare not switch off for a nanosecond. You want an opening that grabs people from the first moment. A surprising statement, an intriguing question, a short story, an incredible image. There are, to be sure, occasions when you can start with a thank you or two, especially when you're speaking at an event where there's a strong sense of community. There, it may absolutely be the right thing to begin with acknowledging a couple of people. It makes you part of the community. But if you do this, please do it in a super personal way, preferably with humor or genuine warmth. Bill Clinton is a master at this. He'll find a personal anecdote that makes the host feel like $1 million, while simultaneously connecting with the rest of the guests as a result. However, even in that community setting, keep your thank yous in check. Long, dry lists of acknowledgements are absolute attention killers in any context. And when you begin your talk proper, make sure it has a compelling opening. Remember that every piece of content in our modern era is part of an attention war. It's fighting against thousands of other claims on people's time and energy. This is true even when you're standing on a stage in front of a seated audience. They have deadly distractors in their pockets, called smartphones, which they can use to summon to their eyes 1,000 outside alternatives. Once emails and texts make their claim, your talk may be doomed. And then there's that lurking demon of modern life, fatigue. All these are lethal enemies. You never want to provide someone with an excuse to zone out. You have to be a savvy general directing this war's outcome. Starting strong is one of your most important weapons. This is especially true if your talk is being recorded for online posterity. Dozens of other enticing talks, articles, and quizzes are just one click away. If you waste the opening minute of your talk, you're going to lose a significant portion of your online audience before they ever realize there's an interesting bit. And that may make the difference between your talk going viral or dying a tragic death. Here are 4 ways to stake your claim to the audience's attention. 1. Deliver a dose of drama. Your first words really do matter. Comic Maysoon Zaid, who who suffers from cerebral palsy due to a botched medical procedure at her birth, came onto the stage shaking and began her talk like this. I am not drunk, but the doctor who delivered me was... Kapow! Despite her unexpected appearance, we immediately knew we were in for a treat. She owned every eyeball and every brain cell in the room. Activist chef Jamie Oliver came to TED to accept our annual TED Prize. Here's how he opened. Sadly, in the next 18 minutes, four Americans that are alive will be dead through the food that they eat. I think you want to hear more. In planning your opening, let your talk's throughline be your guide. How can you tease up the idea of your talk in the most compelling way imaginable? Ask yourself, if your talk were a movie or a novel, how would it open? That doesn't mean you have to cram something dramatic into the opening sentence. You definitely have a few moments of audience attention, but by the end of the first paragraph, something needs to land. Zach Ibrahim came to TED 2014 with an incredible story, but in his original script, he planned to open like this. I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1983 to a loving American mother and an Egyptian father who tried their best to create a happy childhood for me. It wasn't until I was 7 years old that our family dynamics started to change. My father exposed me to a side of Islam that few people, including the majority of Muslims, get to see. But in fact, when people take the time to interact with one another, it doesn't take long to realize that, for the most part, we all want the same things out of life. It's an okay opening, but it doesn't really grab you. We brainstormed with Zach, and here's his revised opening. On November 5th, 1990, a man named El Said Nasser walked into a hotel in Manhattan and assassinated Rabbi Meir Kahana, the leader of the Jewish Defense League. Nasser was initially found not guilty of the murder, but while serving time on lesser charges, he and other men began planning attacks on a dozen New York City landmarks, including tunnels, synagogues, and the United Nations headquarters. Thankfully, those plans were foiled by an FBI informant. Sadly, the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center was not. Nasser would eventually be convicted for his involvement in the plot. El Said Nasser is my father. The audience was riveted. The opening worked online too, his talk quickly notching up 2 million views. Here's the opening of the original script sent to us by sociologist Alice Goffman. When I was a freshman in college at the University of Pennsylvania, I took a sociology class where we were supposed to go out and study the city through first-hand observation and participation. I got a job working at a cafeteria on campus, making sandwiches and salads. My boss was an African-American woman in her 60s who lived in a black neighborhood not far from Penn. The next year, I began tutoring her granddaughter, Aisha, who was a freshman in high school. She's just telling her story in a way that's natural to her, but by the time she got to the conference, she had a revised opening worthy of the searing passion of her talk. On the path that American children travel to adulthood, two institutions oversee the journey. The first is the one we hear a lot about, college. College has some shortcomings, it's expensive, it leaves young people in debt, but all in all, it's a pretty good path. Today, I want to talk about the second institution overseeing the journey from childhood to adulthood in the United States. And that institution is prison. That brilliant framing allowed her to talk about the tragedy of America's incarcerated in a way that demands attention. Hey, they could have been college kids. Of course, it's possible to overdo the drama and actually lose people. Maybe you want to connect with the audience a little before hitting them with a dramatic thunderbolt, and you certainly don't want to oversimplify what you're going to talk about. But done right, this is a compelling way to get a talk started. Two, ignite curiosity. If I offered you the chance to hear a talk on parasites, I'm guessing you might decline. But only if you hadn't met science writer Ed Yong. Here's how he opened his talk. A herd of wildebeests, a shoal of fish, a flock of birds. Many animals gather in large groups that are among the most wonderful spectacles in the natural world. But why do these groups form? The common answers include things like seeking safety in numbers, or hunting in packs, or gathering to mate or breed. And all of these explanations, while often true, make a huge assumption about animal behavior, that the animals are in control of their own actions, that they are in charge of their bodies. And that is often not the case. He goes on to describe how a species of shrimp huddled together only because their brains have been taken over by parasites who need the shrimp to be visible to predator flamingos in whose bellies the parasite can continue its life cycle. In less than a minute flat, your brain is doing somersaults. What? Can nature really do that? And you're crying out to know more. How? Why? What does this mean? Igniting curiosity is the single most versatile tool at your disposal for ensuring audience engagement. If a talk's goal is to build an idea in listeners' minds, then curiosity is the fuel that powers listeners' active participation. Neuroscientists speak of questions creating a knowledge gap that the brain fights to close. The only way the brains of the audience can do that is by having their owners listen hard to what you have to say. This is good. How do you spark curiosity? Well, the obvious way is to ask a question, but not just any question, a surprising question. How do we build a better future for all? Too broad, too much of a cliche. I'm bored already. How did this 14-year-old girl, with less than $200 in her bank account, give her whole town a giant leap into the future? Now we're talking. Sometimes a little illustration can turn a so-so question into full-on curiosity ignition. Here's how philosopher Michael Sandel began. Here's a question we need to rethink together. What should be the role of money and markets in our societies? Are you interested yet? Maybe, maybe not. But here's how he continues. Today, there are very few things that money can't buy. If you're sentenced to a jail term in Santa Barbara, California, you should know that if you don't like the standard accommodations, you can buy a prison cell upgrade. It's true. For how much, do you think? What would you guess? $500? It's not the Ritz-Carlton. It's a jail. $82 a night. If his opening question didn't immediately grab you, the crazy jail example reveals why the question might matter a lot after all. In fact, curiosity-generating speakers often don't explicitly ask a question, at least not at first. They simply frame a topic in an unexpected way that clicks that curiosity button. Here's V.S. Ramachandran. I study the human brain, the functions and structure of the human brain, and I just want you to think for a minute about what this entails. Here is this 3-pound mass of jelly you can hold in the palm of your hand, and it can contemplate the vastness of interstellar space. It can contemplate the meaning of infinity, and it can contemplate itself contemplating on the meaning of infinity. Are you intrigued? I am. Likewise, astronomer Jana Levin found a way to make me intensely curious about her work. I want to ask you all to consider for a second the very simple fact that, by far, most of what we know about the universe comes to us from light. We can stand on the Earth and look up at the night sky and see stars with our bare eyes. The sun burns our peripheral vision. We see light reflected off the moon. And in the time since Galileo pointed that rudimentary telescope at the celestial bodies, the known universe has come to us through light, across vast eras in cosmic history. And with all of our modern telescopes, we've been able to collect this stunning silent movie of the universe, these series of snapshots that go all the way back to the Big Bang. And yet, the universe is not a silent movie, because the universe isn't silent. I'd like to convince you that the universe has a soundtrack, and that soundtrack is played on space itself, because space can wobble like a drum. Curiosity is the magnet that pulls your audience along with you. If you can wield it effectively, you can turn even difficult subjects into winning talks. And by difficult subjects, I don't just mean advanced physics. Even harder are talks about challenging issues and causes. If you want to advance new ideas about HIV or malaria or human slavery, you have to be aware that it's hard for people to open up to these topics. They know they're going to be made to feel uncomfortable at some point. It's tempting to them to shut down ahead of time and pull out the iPhone. A great way to counter that is to lead with curiosity. As mentioned earlier, Emily Oster did this in her talk about AIDS. Instead of the expected litany of horrors her audience may have been expecting, she started by asking whether the four things we all thought we knew about AIDS in Africa were actually true. She had a slide listing them. They looked right, but it was clear she was going to challenge each one. And just like that, a different part of the brain swings into action. Attention was one. If your talk topic is challenging, curiosity is probably your most powerful engine of engagement. 3. Show a compelling slide, video, or object. Sometimes the best opening hook is a glorious, impactful, or intriguing picture or video. Artist Alexa Mead began by showing a striking image of one of her works and speaking these words. "You may want to take a closer look. There's more to this painting than meets the eye. And yes, it's an acrylic painting of a man, but I didn't paint it on canvas. I painted it directly on top of the man." Wow. Elora Hardy began, "When I was 9 years old, my mom asked me what I would want my house to look like, and I drew this fairy mushroom." She shows a cute child's drawing. "And then she actually built it." You can hear the audience's intake of breath as she shows an image of the bamboo house her mother built. It's just the setup for a series of stunning images of Elora's own work as an architect. But look how rapidly she has engaged the audience. Two sentences in, and they're already gasping. If you have the right material, this is clearly a great way to start a talk. Instead of saying, "Today I plan to talk to you about my work, but first I need to give you some background," you can just start by saying, "Let me show you something." Obviously, this approach can work well for photographers, artists, architects, and designers, or others whose work is fundamentally visual. But it can also work beautifully for conceptual talks. When David Christian gave his History of the Universe in 18 minutes, he began with video of an egg being scrambled. It was only after 10 seconds or so that you realized the process was happening in reverse. The egg was being unscrambled. Right there, right in his intriguing opening video, he revealed the through line of his story, that there is a direction to time, that the story of the universe is one of growing complexity. A gorgeous image captures attention, but the full impact often comes in revealing something surprising about it. Carl Zimmer began with a stunningly beautiful picture of a jewel wasp, but he then revealed that it made its living by turning cockroaches into zombies and laying its eggs inside their comatose bodies. Another triumphant entry in that strange niche of TED Talks devoted to truly disturbing parasites. Depending on what material you have, there are plenty of ways to ponder even more intriguing starts. "The image you're about to see changed my life." "I'm going to play you a video that, at first viewing, may seem to be impossible." "Here's my opening slide. Can you figure out what this thing is?" "Until 2.5 months ago, no living human had cast eyes on this object." Find the one that feels right for you. Compelling, but also authentic. An opening that will boost your own confidence going into the talk. 4. Tease, but don't give it away. Occasionally, speakers try to bring too much to their opening paragraph. They essentially give away the punchline of their talk. "Today, I'm going to explain to you that the key to success as an entrepreneur is simply this, determination." A worthy goal, but the speaker may have already lost the audience. They think they know the talk already. Even if what follows is full of nuance, logic, passion, and persuasion, they may no longer be listening. Suppose instead the talk started this way. "Over the next few minutes, I plan to reveal what I believe is the key to success as an entrepreneur, and how anyone here can cultivate it. You'll find clues to it in the story I'm about to tell." You'll probably give that speaker at least a few more minutes of your attention. So instead of giving it all away up front, imagine what kind of language will seduce the audience into wanting to come along for the ride. Different audience, different language. "As a child, I didn't much like to be dragged out walking. My parents made a valiant effort at audience empathy, but failed. They'd say, "Let's go for a hike. We'll get to see a beautiful view of the valley." And the unfit little six-year-old that was me, who frankly didn't care at all about views, would whine all the way there and back. Later, they got wise and went for a more cleverly crafted pitch. "We've got a treat for you. We're going somewhere special where you can launch a paper airplane into 5 miles of empty space." As a fan of anything that flew, I was out the door before they were. It was the same walk. It's okay to save the big revelations for the middle or end of your talk. In the opening sentence, your sole goal is to give your audience a reason to step away from their comfort zone and accompany you on an amazing journey of discovery. As J.J. Abrams pointed out in his TED talk on the power of mystery, the movie Jaws owes a lot of its impact to the fact that director Steven Spielberg hid the shark for the first half of the movie. You knew it was coming, for sure, but its invisibility helped keep you on the edge of your seat. As you plan your talk, there's no harm in channeling your inner Spielberg. Edith Widder did just that, albeit with help from a different sea creature. When she gave a talk on her team's discovery of the giant squid, she of course wanted a powerful opening. Did she show the amazing footage of the squid? Oh no. Instead, her opening slide was a dramatic artist's image of the Kraken, the squid-like sea monster of Norwegian legend. That allowed her to set up the story she was going to tell as rooted deep in mythology. The moment when the giant squid appears is 100 times more dramatic for being held back. The technique works for astonishing creatures, and it also works for astonishing breakthroughs. Stanford professor Fei-Fei Li came to TED in 2015 to present her remarkable work showing how machine learning has enabled computers to visually identify the contents of photographs. But she didn't start with a demo. She started with a video of a 3-year-old child looking at pictures and identifying their contents. That's a cat sitting in a bed. The boy is petting the elephant. She then helped us understand how amazing the skill being demonstrated by the child was, and how consequential it would be if we could train computers to develop similar capabilities. It was a beautiful setup to describe her work. The jaw-dropping demos of artificial intelligence came later, and we were hooked all the way. If you decide to tease a little, please note that it's still very important to indicate where you're going and why. You don't have to show the shark, but we do need to know it's coming. Every talk needs mapping, a sense of where you're going, where you are, and where you've been. If your listeners don't know where they are in the structure of the talk, they will quickly get lost. In crafting your own opening, you can draw inspiration from any or all of the above. You can also build in some of the techniques discussed earlier, tell a story maybe, or get people laughing. The key is simply to find a good fit for you and for what you're talking about. Test it on friends. If it feels contrived or overly dramatic, change it. Just bear in mind that your goal is to persuade someone, in only a few moments, that your talk is going to be a worthy investment of their attention. When I was in the magazine business, I urged our editors and designers to think of magazine covers as having to compete in a 2-stage war for attention. First, the half-second war. As someone's eyes scanned across a newsstand, was there something attention-grabbing on the cover that would make her stop for a moment? Next, the 5-second war. Once she'd stopped to look, would she read something compelling enough on the cover to make her pick up the magazine? You can think of a talk opening the same way, except with different timings. First, there is the 10-second war. Can you do something in your first moments on stage to ensure people's eager attention while you set up your talk topic? Second is the 1-minute war. Can you then use that first minute to ensure that they're committed to coming on the full talk journey with you? The 4 techniques above offer excellent options for winning both stages of that war, thereby giving your talk its best shot. You may want to combine 2 or more of them in your opening, though you certainly shouldn't try to use all of them. Pick the ones that feel right to you, and then you and your fully engaged audience will be on your way together. If you've held people's attention through the talk, don't ruin it with a flat ending. As Danny Kahneman explained so powerfully in both his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, and in his TED Talk, how people remember an event may be very different from how they experienced it. And when it comes to remembering, your final experience is really important. In short, if the ending isn't memorable, the talk itself may not be. Here's how not to end. Well, that's my time gone, so I'll wrap up there. You mean you had a lot more to say but can't tell us because of bad planning? Finally, I just want to thank my awesome team who are pictured here. David, Joanna, Gavin, Samantha, Lee, Abdul, and Hezekiah, also my university and my sponsors. Lovely. But do you care about them more than your idea? And more than us, your audience? So, given the importance of this issue, I hope we can start a new conversation about it together. A conversation? Isn't that a little lame? What should be the outcome of that conversation? The future is full of challenges and opportunities. Everyone here has it in their heart to make a difference. Let's dream together. Let's be the change we want to see in the world. Beautiful sentiment, but the clichés really don't help anyone. I'll close with this video, which summarizes my points. No, never end with a video. End with you. So, that concludes my argument. Now, are there any questions? Or how to preempt your own applause? I'm sorry, I haven't had time to discuss some of the major issues here, but hopefully this has at least given you a flavor of the topic. Don't apologize. Plan more carefully. Your job was to give the best talk you could in the time available. In closing, I should just point out that my organization could probably solve this problem if we were adequately funded. You have it in your power to change the world with us. Ah, so this was a fundraising pitch all along. Thanks for being such an amazing audience. I have loved every moment standing here talking to you. I'll carry this experience with me for a long, long time. You've been so patient, and I know that you'll take what you've heard today and do something wonderful with it. Thank you would have been just fine. It's amazing how many talks simply fizzle out, and how many more go through a series of false endings, as if the speaker can't bear to leave the stage. Unless you plan your ending carefully, you may well find yourself adding paragraph after paragraph. Finally, the key point, as I said. So, in conclusion, and just to emphasize again the reason this matters, and of course it's important to still bear in mind. Oh, and one last thing. It's exhausting, and it will damage the talk's impact. Here are 7 better ways to end. 1. Camera pullback. You've spent the talk explaining a particular piece of work. At the end, why not show us the bigger picture, a broader set of possibilities implied by your work? David Eagleman showed that the human brain could be thought of as a pattern recognizer, and that if you were to connect new electrical data to a brain, it could come to interpret that data as if coming from a brand new sense organ, so that you could intuitively sense brand new aspects of the world in real time. He ended by hinting at the limitless possibilities this brought with it. Just imagine an astronaut being able to feel the overall health of the International Space Station, or for that matter, having you feel the invisible states of your own health, like your blood sugar and the state of your microbiome, or having 360-degree vision, or seeing in infrared or ultraviolet. So the key is this, as we move into the future, we're going to increasingly be able to choose our own peripheral devices. We no longer have to wait for Mother Nature's sensory gifts on her timescales, but instead, like any good parent, she's given us the tools that we need to go out and define our own trajectory. So the question now is, how do you want to go out and experience your universe? 2. Call to action. If you've given your audience a powerful idea, why not end by nudging them to act on it? Harvard Business School professor Amy Cuddy concluded her talk on power posing by inviting people to try it in their own lives and to pass it on to others. Give it away, share it with people, because the people who can use it the most are the ones with no resources and no technology and no status and no power. Give it to them because they can do it in private. They need their bodies, privacy, and 2 minutes, and it can significantly change the outcomes of their life. Perhaps that confident call contributed to the talk's extraordinary viral success. In his talk on public shaming, author John Ronson's final call to action was admirably succinct. The great thing about social media was how it gave a voice to voiceless people, but we're now creating a surveillance society where the smartest way to survive is to go back to being voiceless. Let's not do that. 3. Personal commitment. It's one thing to call on the audience to act, but sometimes speakers score by making a giant commitment of their own. The most dramatic example of this at TED was when Bill Stone spoke of the possibilities of humans returning to the moon and his conviction that an expedition could create a massive new industry and open up space exploration for a new generation. Then he said this: "I would like to close here by putting a stake in the sand at TED. I intend to lead that expedition." A personal commitment like that can be incredibly compelling. Remember the Elon Musk example from Chapter 1. "For my part, I will never give up, and I mean never." That was the key to re-energizing his SpaceX team. In 2011, the swimmer Diana Nyad gave a TED Talk in which she described how she had tried to do what no one had ever achieved, to swim from Cuba to Florida. She had tried on 3 occasions, sometimes persisting for 50 hours of constant swimming, braving dangerous currents and near-lethal jellyfish stings, but ultimately failing. At the end of her talk, she electrified the audience by saying this: "That ocean's still there. This hope is still alive. And I don't want to be the crazy woman who does it for years and years and years and tries and fails and tries and fails and tries and fails. I can swim from Cuba to Florida, and I will swim from Cuba to Florida." And sure enough, 2 years later, she returned to the TED stage to describe how, at age 64, she had finally done it. As with everything, making a major commitment requires judgment. Done wrong, it could lead to awkwardness in the moment and a loss of credibility later. But if you're passionate about turning an idea into action, it may well be worth stepping up to. 4. Values and vision. Can you turn what you've discussed into an inspiring or hopeful vision of what might be? Many speakers try. The late Rita Pearson, who gave a beautiful talk on how teachers need to build real relationships with their kids, ended with this: "Teaching and learning should bring joy. How powerful would our world be if we had kids who were not afraid to take risks, who were not afraid to think, and who had a champion? Every child deserves a champion, an adult who will never give up on them, who understands the power of connection and insists that they become the best that they can possibly be. Is this job tough? You betcha. Oh God, you betcha. But it is not impossible. We can do this. We're educators. We're born to make a difference. Thank you so much." Rita passed away a couple of months after giving this talk, but her call continues to resonate. Teacher Kitty Boitnot wrote a moving tribute: "I did not know her, and I did not know of her until today. But today, through her talk, she touched my life and reminded me why I was a teacher for over 3 decades." 5. Satisfying encapsulation. Sometimes speakers find a way to neatly reframe the case they've been making. Therapist Esther Perel called for a new, more honest approach to infidelity that included the possibility of forgiveness. She ended like this: "I look at affairs from a dual perspective, hurt and betrayal on one side, growth and self-discovery on the other, what it did to you and what it meant for me. And so when a couple comes to me in the aftermath of an affair that has been revealed, I will often tell them this: today, in the West, most of us are going to have 2 or 3 relationships or marriages, and some of us are going to do it with the same person. Your first marriage is over. Would you like to create a second one together?" And Amanda Palmer, who has challenged the music industry to rethink its business model, ended this way: "I think people have been obsessed with the wrong question, which is, how do we make people pay for music? What if we started asking, how do we let people pay for music?" In both cases, a surprising question carried with it a pleasing moment of insight and closure and prompted a long-standing ovation. 6. Narrative symmetry. A talk built carefully on a through line can deliver a pleasing conclusion by linking back to its opening. Stephen Johnson began his talk on where ideas come from by revealing the significance of coffee houses in industrial Britain. They were places where intellectuals gathered to spark off each other. Toward the end, he told the powerful story of how GPS was invented, illustrating all his points on how ideas emerge. And then, brilliantly, he threw in the fact that GPS was probably used by everyone in the audience that week to do things like find their nearest coffee house. You can hear in the audience a little gasp of appreciation and applause at the satisfying way the narrative has come full circle. 7. Lyrical inspiration. Sometimes, if the talk has opened people up, it's possible to end with poetic language that taps deep into matters of the heart. This should not be tried lightly, but when it works, it's quite beautiful. Here's how Brené Brown ended her talk on vulnerability. This is what I have found. To let ourselves be seen, deeply seen, vulnerably seen. To love with our whole hearts, even though there's no guarantee. To practice gratitude and joy in those moments of terror, when we're wondering, can I love you this much? Can I believe in this passionately? Can I be this fierce about this? Just to be able to stop and say, I'm just so grateful because to feel this vulnerable means I'm alive. And the last, which I think is probably the most important, is to believe that we're enough. Because when we work from a place, I believe, that says I'm enough, then we stop screaming and start listening. We're kinder and gentler to the people around us, and we're kinder and gentler to ourselves. That's all I have. Thank you. And human rights lawyer Brian Stevenson closed his blockbuster talk on the injustices of the US prison system with this. I've come to TED because I believe that many of you understand that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice, that we cannot be fully evolved human beings until we care about human rights and basic dignity, that all of our survival is tied to the survival of everyone, that our visions of technology and design and entertainment and creativity have to be married with visions of humanity, compassion, and justice. And more than anything, for those of you who share that, I've simply come to tell you to keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. I repeat, you cannot do this lightly. It only works when the rest of the talk has already prepared the groundwork, and when it's clear the speaker has earned the right to evoke such sentiment. But in the right hands, and at the right moment, these closings can be transcendent. Whichever way you end, make sure it's planned. An elegant closing paragraph, followed by a simple thank you, offers the best shot at a satisfying end to your efforts. It's worth figuring out. On stage. 14. Wardrobe. What should I wear? Many speakers worry about the clothes they should wear to make the best impression, and I'm probably the last person they should turn to for advice. I'm the guy who showed up on stage one year with my beautiful bright yellow sleeveless sweater vest over a hip-as-hell black t-shirt and black trousers, thinking I looked terrific, while the audience simply wondered, why did that man dress as a bumblebee? I, therefore, have handed over this section to TED's content director, Kelly Stetzel, who has both fabulous style and a magnificent ability to put speakers at their ease. Here's her advice.
The last thing you need is wardrobe stress in the hours leading up to your talk. And selecting an outfit is one thing you can check off your to-do list early. In most settings, all that matters is that you wear something you feel great in. At TED, we like reasonably casual clothes, giving the sense that we're all on a retreat together. Other places may expect a suit and tie. You probably don't want the audience's first unconscious thought about you to be any of the following: stodgy, slovenly, tasteless, boring, or trying too hard. But if you avoid those potential traps, wearing something that makes you feel good will help you project relaxed confidence, and audiences will respond to that. Believe it or not, your clothing can earn you an audience connection before you've even spoken a word. As you think about what you'll wear, there are a few questions worth asking, such as, is there a dress code? how is the audience likely to be dressed? You'll probably want to dress somewhat like they do, but a little bit smarter. Will you be filmed? If so, avoid wearing brilliant white. It can blow out the shot. Or jet black. You might look like a floating head. Or anything with a small or tight pattern. It can cause a strange shimmery moiré effect on camera. Will you be using an over-the-ear microphone? There are some risks here. Several times, a speaker had just started speaking when strange, loud, clanking noises erupted from nowhere. They're caused by earrings banging into the microphone attachment. Avoid dangling earrings. Also, men's beard stubble can cause scratching sounds. If you're choosing accessories, avoid jangly bracelets or anything flashy that might cause a reflection. Scarves can be a good way to bring in a pop of color if you've chosen to wear something neutral. You'll likely be wearing the mic's battery pack on your belt, and you'll probably feel most secure if you have a firm belt or defined waistline where you can attach the pack. What will the stage look like? Consider wearing something bright that sets you apart from the background. Think about dressing for the people sitting in the back row. TED Women speaker Linda Cliott Wayman wore a beautiful bright pink dress that ensured she didn't blend in, and all eyes were on her from the moment she took the stage until her final applause. The audience loves bold, vibrant colors, and so does the camera. Fitted clothing tends to look better on stage than outfits that are loose and baggy. Look for something with a nice silhouette and make sure it's the right size. Not too slack, not too tight. While it's good to consider these guidelines, personal expressions of style can trump them all. A couple of weeks before TED 2015, we sent a note to speakers with a few final reminders, including a recommendation that men steer clear of ties. Radio host Roman Mars replied with, "Why no ties? Ties are great." We told him that if ties were his special thing, then he should simply ignore our suggestion. He wore one, he felt great, looked great, and fit right in. Book designer Chip Kidd has also delightfully broken the TED no tie rule with his strong, wonderful sense of style. If you're still unsure what to wear, book a shopping date with a friend whose taste you trust. Sometimes the way you see yourself in the mirror isn't exactly the same way others see you. I almost always do this myself, and I've regretted it the times I haven't. Another opinion can be invaluable. Before you take the stage, be sure your clothes are neatly pressed. Wrinkled clothes are the single easiest way to telegraph that you didn't try very hard. If you're speaking late in the day, it may even be worth bringing your clothes on a hanger and changing into them closer to the time of your presentation. An important lesson I learned the hard way: if you plan to use a hotel iron, press your clothes the night before and test the iron on a towel first. Those irons often aren't in the best shape, and they can be leaky or even dirty. The TED Fellows team brings a small, packable personal steamer with them to help wrinkled speakers. It's worth rehearsing your talk in the outfit you plan to wear. I remember a speaker whose clothing shifted early in her talk so that both bra straps fell off her shoulders and were hanging down on her arms through almost the entire talk. Our editors were able to work some magic so you can't notice this mishap in the video, but it could have been avoided completely with a dress rehearsal and a couple of safety pins. Once again, the most important thing is just to wear something that boosts your confidence. This is something you can control in advance, and it will give you one less thing to worry about and one more thing working in your favor. And back to Chris.
Thank you, Kelly. People, take note. And when all said and done, don't overthink this part. Your passion and your ideas matter a lot more than how you look. When Professor Barry Schwartz showed up at the TED stage in Oxford for his talk on the paradox of choice, it was a hot summer's day, and he was wearing a T-shirt and shorts. He tells me if he had known we were going to video him and put him online, he might have chosen something else. But it didn't stop his talk notching up 7 million views. Amanda Palmer says her sole regret of her talk prep was choosing a grey shirt that turned black with underarm perspiration. But the audience thought it was just part of her break-the-rules approach to life, and the talk was a massive hit, both live and online. So, in summary, 1, do what Kelly says. 2, make an early commitment to an outfit you'll feel great in. 3, focus on your ideas, not your clothes. 15. Mental prep. How do I control my nerves? Fear triggers our ancient fight or flight response. Your body is coiled up chemically, ready to strike or flee. This is measurable physically by a huge rise in adrenaline coursing through your bloodstream. Adrenaline's great for powering a sprint to safety across the savannah, and it can certainly bring energy and excitement to your stage presence. But too much of it is a bad thing. It can dry up your mouth and tighten your throat. Its job is to turbocharge your muscles, and if your muscles are not being used, the adrenaline rush may start them twitching, hence the shaking associated with extreme cases of nerves. Some coaches advise medication in such cases, typically beta blockers. But the downside is that they can deaden your tone. There are plenty of other counter-strategies to turn all that adrenaline to your advantage. Let's return to Monica Lewinsky. In Chapter 1, she described the intensity of her nervousness in approaching her TED Talk. If she could overcome her nerves, I'm guessing you can too. In her own words, here's how she did it. In some forms of meditation, the guidance is to return to the breath or your mantra when your mind wanders or monkey mind sets in. I did that with my anxiety. I tried my best to return to the purpose of my speech as often as possible. One of my two mantras was, "This matters." In fact, I had it scrawled across the top of page one of my speech that was on stage with me. The other mantra that worked well for me was, "I've got this." If you are going to be standing on a stage addressing an audience, it means someone somewhere decided you had something of import to impart to others. I spent time articulating to myself how I hoped my speech might help others who were suffering. I clung to the meaning and purpose of my speech as a life raft. I had tools that worked for me. I pulled out all the stops in terms of support and having my tanks as full as possible for the day of the speech and leading up to it. I have spent a lot of time in the last 17 years learning to manage my anxiety and past trauma. The morning of the speech, in no particular order, I used bioresonance sound work, breathing exercises, a therapy called emotional freedom technique, commonly known as tapping. I did this backstage moments before going on. Chanted, did various warm-up exercises with my public speaking coach, went for a walk to move the adrenaline in my body, made sure I laughed at least once, grounding visualization, and lastly, I power posed, lucky me, with the inimitable Amy Cuddy. There was more than one moment where I doubted my ability to see the speech through. The night before the speech content rehearsal, 3 weeks before the conference, I broke down in tears, exasperated that the content was just not gelling. I planned to bow out after the rehearsal, but I was shocked by the positive reception. I kept waiting for the however and but. They never came. I sat with the response for a long time after, still unsure, but I ultimately concluded, if people who knew what they were doing when it came to TED Talks thought the speech was compelling enough, I should stick with it. I was simply too close to it. Throughout the process, when faced with self-doubt, I focused as much as I could on the message to deliver instead of the messenger. Whenever I felt nervous or unsure, I had to simply steel myself and try to self-reason that all I could do was my best, and that if I could reach one person with my message and help just one person feel less alone in their experience of shame and online humiliation, it would be worth it. The experience proved to be life-changing for me on many levels. That's as exhaustive a set of nervousness-controlling tools as you'll ever see. Should you try to adopt every one of Monica's techniques? No. Everyone's different. But the fact that she was able to turn crippling fear into a calm, confident, engaging stage presence should encourage anyone that it can be done. Here's what I recommend. Use your fear as motivation. That's what it's there for. It will make it easier for you to truly commit to practicing your talk as many times as it takes. In doing that, your confidence will rise, your fear will ebb, and your talk will be better than it otherwise would have been. Let your body help you. There's a series of important things you can do before going on stage that really help circumvent the adrenaline rush. The single most important one is to breathe. Breathe deeply, meditation style. The oxygen infusion brings calm with it. You can do this even if you're seated in the audience, waiting to be called up. Just take a deep breath right into your stomach and let it out slowly. Repeat 3 times more. If you're off stage and you're feeling tension surging through your body, it's worth trying more vigorous physical exercise. At TED 2014, I was super stressed about the prospect of interviewing Richard Ledgett of the NSA about the Edward Snowden controversy. 10 minutes before the session, I escaped to a backstage corridor and started doing push-ups. And I couldn't stop. I ended up doing 30% more than I thought was the most I was capable of. It was all adrenaline. And by burning it that way, calm and confidence returned. Drink water. The worst aspect of nerves is when the adrenaline sucks the water from your mouth and you struggle to speak. Controlling the adrenaline, as above, is the best antidote, but it's also good to make sure you're fully hydrated. 5 minutes before you go on, try to drink a third of a bottle of water. It'll help stop your mouth from getting dry. But don't do this too early. Salman Khan did, and then had to rush to the men's room just before his introduction. He was back in the nick of time. Avoid an empty stomach. When you're nervous, eating may be the last thing you want to do, but an empty stomach can exacerbate anxiety. Get some healthy food into your body an hour or so before you're on, and or have a protein bar handy. Remember the power of vulnerability. Audiences embrace speakers who are nervous, especially if the speaker can find a way to acknowledge it. If you flub or stutter a little in your opening remarks, it's fine to say, "Oops, sorry, a little nervous here," or, "As you can see, I don't do a lot of public speaking, but this one mattered too much to turn down." Your listeners will begin rooting for you even more. At a packed Sydney Opera House, singer-songwriter Megan Washington confessed to the TEDx audience that she had battled all her life with the stutter they could hear. Her honesty and initial awkwardness made the song she flawlessly performed all the more glorious. Find friends in the audience. Early on in the talk, look out for faces that seem sympathetic. If you can find 3 or 4 in different parts of the audience, give the talk to them, moving your gaze from one to the next in turn. Everyone in the audience will see you connecting, and the encouragement you get from those faces will bring you calm and confidence. Maybe you even ensure that some of your actual friends are seated around the auditorium. Speak to them. As an aside, speaking to friends will help you find the right tone of voice, too. Have a backup plan. If you're worried about things going wrong, plan a few backup moves. You fear you might forget what you were going to say? Have notes or a script within reach. Roz Savage had hers tucked inside her shirt. No one minded at all when she lost her way a couple of times and referred to them. Scared the technology may go wrong and you'll have to vamp? Well, first of all, that's the organizer's problem, not yours. But no harm in having a little story to tell if you need to fill in. All the better if it's personal. While they sort that out, let me share with you a conversation I just had with a taxi driver. Or, "Oh, this is great. Now I have a chance to mention to you something I had to cut from the talk for time reasons." Or, "Great, we have a couple of extra minutes. So let me ask a question of you. Who here has ever..." Focus on what you're talking about. Monica's suggestion to write "This matters" on your notes is wonderful. This is the single biggest piece of advice I can give you. It's not about you. It's about the idea you're passionate about. Your job is to be there in service of that idea, to offer it as a gift. If you can hold that in mind as you walk onto the stage, you'll find it liberating. Singer Joe Cowan was paralyzed by nerves to the point that it prevented him from doing what he most loved, singing to people. So he took it on, one step at a time, forcing himself to perform in small venues even when he could hear the nervous squeak in his voice, and eventually writing a stage fright song that he'd wheel out in performances if need be. Audiences loved it, and he came to embrace his nerves as friends. He has a delightful talk and song explaining how he did it. At a conference in Toronto 15 years ago, I watched as novelist Barbara Gowdy froze on stage. She simply stood there quaking. She couldn't speak. She had thought she was going to be interviewed, but at the last moment was told she had to speak. The fear was oozing out of every pore in her body. But the most amazing thing happened. The audience began applauding her and cheering. She started hesitantly, stopped, more applause. And then she began sharing the most eloquent, intimate insights into her thinking and process. It was the most memorable talk of that conference. If she had just come on confidently and started speaking, we wouldn't have listened as closely or cared as intensely. Nerves are not a curse. They can be turned to great effect. Make friends with your nervousness, pluck up your courage, and go. 16. Setup. Lectern, confidence monitor, note cards, or gulp, nothing? The physical setup of your talk really matters. Compare setup A, a speaker standing on a podium behind a big, bulky lectern reading from a script to a somewhat distant audience, with setup B, a speaker standing unprotected on a small stage, surrounded on three sides by an audience. Both are called public speaking, but they're actually very different activities. Setup B can seem terrifying. You stand there, vulnerable, with no laptop, no script, your whole body visible, nowhere to hide, painfully aware of all the eyes staring at you from not very far away. Setup A has evolved over the years to accommodate every speaker need. Before electricity, a speaker might have had a small lectern on which to place some notes.